Okay, any preliminary questions or issues? Okay, we left off yesterday with the tail end of the Carter case, and we were essentially at the point of figuring out what the court was going to do and why it was going to do it. Who was telling us about Carter? Good. It's Mr. Mayer, right? Okay. Then give us the bottom line here. What does the court finally conclude about whether Mr. Carter can make a claim for his fear of cancer? Yet. That is, he may someday get one, and at such time, obviously, he would have the right to, in effect, renew his claim and say, now I've been injured, now, like the tombstone that said, I told you I was sick. You know, here he can say, yeah, I was afraid of getting this for good reason. But obviously one of the things that the court is concerned about is how this case will affect other kinds of cases. Let's suppose, for example, that we allowed him to proceed with this claim and we assessed his fear of cancer and we made a monetary award to him to compensate him for the fear and elevated risk of getting cancer. But then suppose 10 years from now he actually gets cancer. What then? Right. And one of the reasons why we like that scenario is that in the alternative, if we asked or if we did what he asked us to do now, which was to make him an award today, what would happen if he came back in 10 years and said, by the way, things are a whole lot worse. Now I want compensation for actually having cancer. What would our response to him be then if we gave him an award today? You got your one bite of the apple. And it's an important principle in any kind of tort recovery that you get your one bite of the apple, but that's it. When a plaintiff suffers an injury, there may be uncertainty about how this injury will proceed in the future. So that, let's say you're in an automobile accident and you've got, you know, soft tissue injury, whiplash kind of a thing, and the medical expectation is that you're at greater risk for arthritis, you're probably going to be at greater risk for some kind of back or cervical problems in the future. The jury is asked to make their best judgment about the extent to which the plaintiff deserves compensation based on what we know today about what might happen in the future. It doesn't happen that the plaintiff comes back in 5 years and says, oh, things are much worse, now I want more money. Nor does it happen that the defendant can come back in 5 years and say, remember how we were worried that the plaintiff might get arthritis? Well, guess what? They really didn't. So I want part of my money back. We do neither of those things. Once the jury makes the award, we're done. And it's actually a line that many plaintiff's lawyers use in making their pitch to the jury in closing argument to say, ladies and gentlemen, my client's going to be suffering with this for 20 years or 30 years, but the only time we have to ask for compensation is today. And I know I'm asking you for a lot of money here, but this has got to last her for 20 or 30 years. I can't come back and ask for more. So if my client's ever going to get compensated for this, it has to be today. Well, because in a nuisance case, the harm continues, at least it may, so that if, for example, I suffer from a landfill that's next to me and the fumes from this landfill blow over into my property and I file a claim for damages, I don't ask for, perhaps I'm not entitled to an injunction to close it, but I am entitled to the damages caused by the offensive odors and so forth. If the winds change, you know, I recover my damages for what's happened to me. If the defendant continues its operation and I get injured again, I come back and get another round of damages. Again, one of the arguments in favor of giving the plaintiff the right to injunctive relief is that the plaintiff shouldn't have to continue asking for compensation for damage. If in fact it's a wrong, the plaintiff should be entitled to have it stopped. But again, in a nuisance case, you have a continuing injury, whereas if you're in an automobile accident, the defendant runs one red light, and presumably the defendant's not going to run a red light in the future and whack the plaintiff in the intersection. So we're only concerned about a one-time compensatory award. Mr. Brown? Good question, and in fact, as you described that thinking process, it may illuminate the fact that the plaintiff in this case may have actually preferred what the court decided, that the plaintiff supposedly lost this case, but in reality the plaintiff won something else, which is, in effect, when this disease manifests later on, there will be no question that the statute of limitations didn't commence running until a much later date. I mean, it's very clear, if you were the defendant in this case, if the plaintiffs hadn't brought this action, despite what the defendants are arguing today, if the plaintiffs hadn't brought this action and the plaintiff had waited, suppose the plaintiff went to the a plaintiff's lawyer, and the lawyer said, well, gee, I really don't think you're injured yet. Why don't you wait until you've really been injured and then file a claim? There's no question that if they had waited and they didn't have this decision and filed the claim when he actually got injured, the defendant would argue you're barred by the statute of limitations because, look, you knew that you'd been exposed to this. You had the right to file a claim earlier, and you sat on your rights. Now, as a result of this decision saying that the plaintiff doesn't have a right to proceed with a claim for compensation, as a matter of law, the statute of limitations hasn't begun to run yet. At some point, and this is a very difficult question in asbestos cases or secondhand smoke cases or you can imagine a variety of other toxic exposure cases where the plaintiff has this gradual onset of health problems. And it's hard in many cases to identify what's attributable to getting older as distinguished from a health condition. Let's suppose the guy used to be able to, jog or go for long walks, and as he gets into his 40s or his 50s, he begins to feel a lot of shortness of breath. He goes out for a walk, and in a couple of blocks, he's winded. He doesn't know whether that's, well, I can't fit into the same pants I wore when I was a younger guy. Okay, yeah, these things. How am I supposed to know that, in fact, my shortness of breath is because I worked on those asbestos countertops when I was in my 30s, and now that stuff is coming home to roost? Again, the standard for purposes of the statute of limitations, we'll pick this up in Chapter 7, you have an obligation to seek a legal remedy. The clock begins to run on your claim when you knew or reasonably should have known of your right to sue. It's not your knowledge of the law, but your knowledge of the facts that would give you the right to sue. And again, that's a tricky, it isn't a bright line in a lot of these cases, as it is in an automobile accident. I can identify the hour and the minute when my claim for compensation accrued, that's the expression, the accrual of the cause of action, in an intersection collision case. One minute I was happy-go-lucky, and the next minute I was pinned in the wreckage of this car. That's when I had the right to sue. But again, this case illustrates in a toxic exposure case that oftentimes there's this long latency period, gradual manifestation of the symptoms of a disease, but they're not yet a significant interference with my quality of life. I suffer, let's say, from shortness of breath, and I'm not clear about whether that's a result of my exposure to asbestos or just the fact that I'm getting older. If that's my situation, how is a jury supposed to say, well, on October 6th, you knew or should have known you had a claim against the asbestos manufacturer or the people that exposed you to this, and that was the day when the clock started running, and 3 years from October 6th, the statute of limitations barred your claim? Why not November 6th? Why not February of the next year? What is it and in the actual cases, I actually did some asbestos litigation and sat through depositions of claimants in these cases, and you try to reconstruct. Well, when did you go to the doctor? What did the doctor tell you? What sort of symptoms did you have? And in other cases, particularly where there are other risk factors at work. So in the asbestos cases, many of the victims also smoked. So many of the symptoms of asbestos exposure would interchange with symptoms of smoking. And what are we supposed to do with that information? Again, these are very difficult questions, even if the legal principle is relatively clear, that you have an obligation to start acting on your claims when you knew or should or reasonably should have known of your right, of the facts giving rise to your right to sue. Applying that in a specific case is pretty tough. It turns out to be a fairly plaintiff-friendly standard, to the extent that the jury is pretty clear on the fact that the effect of finding that as of this date the plaintiff knew or should have known of their right to sue, that bars the claim. You can imagine that a jury that's otherwise impressed with the plaintiff's claim for liability is going to be reluctant to bar a plaintiff's claim by saying, well, you know, to the extent they have discretion to say, we find that the first date of knowledge was in March of this year rather than in July of 2 years previously, the jury's probably going to err on the side of generosity rather than being very strict about saying, oh, you should have known when your doctor told you about this that was asbestos exposure, and you should have run down to your lawyer and filed a lawsuit. But again, that's the legal standard that we have is fairly murky on that point. I also wanted to emphasize, as I think I did yesterday, that there are lots of these toxic exposure cases. As we get more and more sophisticated about tracing various kinds of environmental influences, whether it's electromagnetic radiation or chemicals or other kinds of things that are in our environment that have adverse health consequences, the range of potential claims of people whose risk has been elevated, that's a pretty large group. And to what extent is it desirable to either extend tort liability to allow people to make these kinds of claims, and to what extent is it something where you want to narrowly define the extent of tort liability for other policy reasons. So again, one of the factors bearing on the court at this point is the idea that granting the plaintiff's remedy today could potentially bar the more serious, important claim down the road. And that in many ways, they're doing the plaintiffs a favor by saying the statute of limitations will not commence running until you have an actual manifestation of adverse health consequences. Even if I can see, I can see those little asbestos fibers in my lungs, even though I can tell I've been exposed and these little things are ticking time bombs inside of me, I don't have to, my cause of action doesn't begin until I begin to manifest adverse health consequences. And again, which of those symptoms will trigger the knowledge of this disease is an open question. Okay, any further discussion of Carter, Mr. Patel? Good question. That's another of his fears. He has the fear of cancer. He also has the fear of bankruptcy on the part of the company. And that's one of the reasons why the plaintiff might have chosen, not only because he needs the court's explicit instruction, it's too soon, you can wait. If the plaintiff didn't ask for that, the plaintiff might find out later on that they guessed wrong and that they should have filed it sooner. But another reason why the plaintiff pursues this action is to say justice delayed is justice denied. And the answer is if they turn out to be bankrupt, the plaintiff's out of luck. It might consider it, but I think in the long run it tends to balance that against the desirability of making a more accurate assessment. Again, what the court is thinking is that large numbers of plaintiffs in the position similar to Mr. Carter will in effect be overcompensated because we're giving them a percentage risk that they might get cancer, and a few members of that group will be significantly undercompensated because we'll give them a small award today and they'll be barred from a larger award tomorrow. And their preference would be, let's wait until we know how this story ends and then we'll make our award. Sure, there's a risk that the company will be bankrupt at that point, but that's a risk they're willing to take at this point. Mr. Johnson? Well, that's for sure. Well, I mean, I think what both of these last comments illustrate is why the Intermediate Court of Appeals had a different opinion. I mean, that is not an uneducated view. The Intermediate Court of Appeals was impressed by the arguments in favor of permitting these suits to go forward, perhaps for the very reasons you've identified. And it's very much a judgment call at this point of how you weigh the relative advantages and disadvantages. Again, I hope that as you look at cases like this, both the ones where you're nodding your head in agreement with the court's ultimate conclusion and those where you shake your head in disbelief at what the court comes up with, that you get an appreciation of the fact that these are really difficult policy judgments that the court has to make, and it's one of the reasons to be fairly cautious and circumspect as you look at a case like this and say, well, my inclination would be this. It seems quite logical that a court would reach this conclusion, but I can certainly imagine how somebody might be more impressed with these countervailing arguments and reach just the opposite conclusion. And by having that capacity to sort of imagine the best case on both sides, you're better prepared, or your client winds up being better prepared for the twists and turns of the way the case may develop, as distinguished from having a thoroughly well-considered, well-argued position, but you in effect overstate the rationality, or at least the degree to which the judicial system corresponds to your idea of what would be rational. You don't want to do your client the disservice of, in effect, guaranteeing, oh, we've got this great system and they always come up with the right result. You want to be prepared for the court to reach a different conclusion. And where these things, as I say, involve these difficult policy judgments, there's a lot more room for people to weigh those in competing or conflicting ways. Well, okay. First of all, I'll take your first question, which is, in effect, a commentary on the desirability of solving these kinds of problems through the tort system. I think that you can make a strong argument looking at these cases for turning off the tort system and turning to some different, as you say, something like a trust fund or a legislatively acquired compensation fund, which then gets distributed. Look what happened in 9/11. We did not let the tort system, this is also for various political, military, national security reasons, we did not let the tort system decide whether anybody was at fault in allowing two planes to crash into the World Trade Center and take 3,000 lives. We said we're going to remove that from the tort system. We're going to set up a completely different compensation fund, and we're going to administer it bureaucratically. And there, as you may know, there have been lots of disputes over how you know, the janitor that gets killed on the 16th floor gets a different award, or his family gets a different award from the stockbroker up on the 73rd floor. And there have been people who say, a life's a life, you know. Sure, the stockbroker's making a better living, but are you really saying that his family deserves more money than the janitor's family? So all those questions about how you administer such a fund, but many people would argue that our money is better spent, the victims get better treated by something administered in that way than putting them through the tort system. I think I may have quoted before, there was a Rand Corporation study of the asbestos cases. This study is, I think, 20 years old. But they carefully reviewed the evidence about asbestos claims handled through the tort system, and when they counted all the numbers up, for every dollar that society spent on the asbestos cases, a grand 17 cents went to the victims, and the other 83 cents went to lawyers, claims adjusters, judges, insurance companies, and the like. And you could easily decide as a matter of public policy, as a potential victim, I'd prefer to have this money put into a trust fund and then distributed even by a bunch of bureaucrats than to have that same amount of money devoured by the lawyer class. So, yes, it's a very live question. Which of the kinds of injuries in our society do we entrust to the tort system, figuring from the tort system we will get the best kinds of decisions about who has to pay and who gets what? But there are other kinds of injuries or claims where we say, no, the tort system really doesn't work very well for this kind of claim. We're going to do something different. It's going to look more like workers' comp. It's going to look more like the World Trade Center kind of compensatory fund. So that's an answer to question number one. And then I think your comment about the tobacco thing is, I would say, perhaps one of the trial lawyers, although the trial lawyers benefited quite nicely from these tobacco settlements, but the trial lawyers would point to something like that to say, this is what happens to people who trust bureaucracy. If you really want injustice, go begging to a bureaucrat for your recovery. For myself, says the trial lawyer, I'd rather have 12 citizens on a jury given the authority to decide whether I'm entitled to recover from so-and-so. And again, this is part of the ongoing debate about whether the tort system is doing a good job or a lousy job delivering compensation and deciding who has to pay for it. Okay. Again, the question that we've been wrestling with is, how convinced are we that we're going to stick with this rule that says absent physical injury, no recovery? And Johnson versus State of New York, as I've said before, puts that question to us. Are you really saying that unless she's got a bruise or she's bleeding someplace, that she can't recover for mere emotional injury? So can somebody tell us about Johnson? Ms. Walker. Well, she's dead, you know. Go ahead.
The daughter was very distressed and
Okay, and here I'll just pause for a moment to illustrate why this case is in Chapter 3. The case for negligence is very clear. That's not really an issue here. There's no real issue about proximate cause. The reason this case is problematic is because we're not sure whether the damages component fits our standards. Okay, so continue. Okay, and the defendant's response to that claim for injury is? Yeah, where is the bruise? Where is the physical injury? If you don't have that, you don't get to play this game. What's the plaintiff's legal argument as to why this case qualifies for tort compensation? Okay, and notice, this is a very nice place to begin, to say it's not as though we have observed this rule scrupulously, and if we ever departed from it, the end of Western civilization is right around the corner. We've lived with some exceptions to this rule, can't we make room for one more at the table here? Okay, what are these exceptions? Okay, so in other words, if my father dies and somebody sends me a telegram telling me that my father's died and here's when the funeral's going to be or here's where you have where we get. But I don't get that in time. Of course, we're talking about a different kind of technology before telephones and much less email and so forth. But you could see how the negligent failure to transmit a telegram could lead to I don't get to my to the place where my father died so that I can, you know, attend the funeral or make decisions about what happens to him and so forth. Okay, so. Negligent transmission of a telegram has been regarding death has been recognized as an exception. What's the other exception? Why doesn't that apply here? What's that? Right. We shouldn't have a corpse yet. She's still back in the state hospital. Who's got a claim for the negligent mishandling of the corpse? The other Mrs. Emma Johnson. So again, it's an argument in favor of the plaintiff's claim here that the other family is already covered by an existing exception to this rule. Why are we so fussy about saying, now when it turns out, I mean, the other family is going to be unhappy about the fact that, I mean, suppose the body had been cremated and they didn't want cremation or some other thing that happened, she wanted to be dressed up as Little Orphan Annie or, you know, whatever it is, and, you know, some great indignity to the corpse. But apparently that hadn't happened yet. You can imagine how bad it would be. But it does seem anomalous that this claimant is being told, I'm sorry, we don't have a place for you. But we would have a place for the damages to the other woman whose damages one would think would be smaller. And she'd obviously be upset about the fact that her mother had died, but in terms of what happened, it's not so bad. Okay. So, again, there are exceptions, and the plaintiff says, in effect, come on, let's make room at the table for yet another one. And indeed, the court says, I think we can do business here. We can allow this, and they describe the new standard, or at least what they understand, this broader category, not just these individualized cases, but a broader class of exceptions. You can recover even when there's no physical injury, so long as what? Okay, but you can, in lots of cases, you can show that my emotional distress actually arose from the incident of, you know, somebody misplacing my dry cleaning or, you know, failing to deliver my car back on time. What else do we need to be able to play this game? If I don't have a physical injury, what do I need? Okay. In particular, what can we define those special circumstances a little bit more to distinguish them? Well, let me just pause on that point for a moment. I sometimes refer to this as duty schmooty. It's actually discussed in more technical terms in Dillon versus Legg, further into the chapter, in which the court does the highbrow version of that argument in terms of saying, what do you mean there's no duty of care? Duty of care is a conclusion. It's not the beginning of the analysis. It's the result of the analysis. If we decide that you are going to owe compensation if you negligently cause this kind of harm, then what we're saying to the telegraph company is, you owe a duty of care to the recipients of this telegram to make sure it gets there in time for the person to act on it. You owe a duty to the people who are related to the decedent to handle their corpse in a reasonable way. The question of whether you owe a duty of care, as the court says in Dillon versus Legg, is not the beginning of the analysis. It's what we can say when we make the decision, should there or should there not. So again, the lowbrow version of that is duty schmooty. What's all that language about? I really don't know what you're talking about there. So again, I wouldn't say that we can distinguish these cases by saying, well, in one you owe a duty and the other you don't. But what is there about this case that the court says allows us to say with confidence that we ought to make an exception? But that's true. Remember, in Chapter 1, we still have to prove negligence anyway. If we can't prove negligence, we don't get to play this game at all. But assuming we've proved negligence and causation, what kinds of damages will qualify? Yeah. Okay, and a special likelihood. Later on, I think at the end of this opinion, they wind up borrowing this phrase from the Ferrara case, this idea of a guarantee of genuineness. Now, is this a technical term or is this a really bright line? No, but it's kind of a term of art here to say there are some cases that kind of make your jaw drop. So that if, you know, the lady on the train gets back from her evening in town and, well, how was the play or, you know, how was your evening with so-and-so? Well, I got into the train and the conductor let these two drunk guys on. The two drunk guys got into some kind of a pushing and shoving match, and one of them fell over on me. And although I wasn't physically hurt, I was really grossed out. You know, as you describe that, that does not cause your jaw to drop. Whereas if somebody says, I got this telegram saying my mother had died, I went to the wake, I looked in the coffin, you know, and so forth and so on, turned out they had the wrong Mrs. Emma Johnson. Oh, yeah, and I had a bunion yesterday that, you know, I mean, this is the jaw-dropping kind of experience where you say, wow, that's really awful. So to the extent we don't just have the high probability of some emotional harm, the dry cleaner misplaced my blue suit, gave it to the wrong, you know, person, and so I've got the, you know, I don't have anything to wear to this wedding, or or my job interview or whatever. That's going to cause me emotional distress. But the court is saying, ordinarily, you just have to put up with that stuff. But if you can state a set of facts that, in effect, has this guarantee of genuineness, like the guy at the men's warehouse, I guarantee it, that there is going to be emotional, significant emotional harm, then you get to play this game. Then you fit into one of these exceptions. And again, the court's going to have to draw a judgment, you know, a subjective line here to say your case qualifies, yours doesn't. This is one that's got a guarantee of genuineness. This one, well, I'm not saying you weren't hurt. I'm not saying your emotional distress wasn't genuine. I'm just saying it doesn't make my jaw drop. And therefore, I'm going to dismiss your claim. This is the sort of gatekeeping function the judge is going to perform, and that's the rule we have. Yeah. Well, again, the fact that the plaintiff survives a motion for summary judgment doesn't guarantee that the court of, so to speak, that the court of appeals won't disagree with what the trial judge did and say this simply doesn't meet the threshold of the kind of case that's so unusual that it qualifies for an exception to our general rule. The rule is not simply saying absent physical injury, no recovery for potentially fraudulent cases. It is saying even cases where we're satisfied that the plaintiff's claim is authentic and genuine, it's not extraordinary. It's not these special circumstances that say it falls into one of these. And in effect, I think what the court is saying in Johnson versus State of New York is this we can tolerate. It's like overruling a play on the field. You know, what's the standard for the instant replay? Indisputable there's some standard. What's that? Well, but the standard by which they judge whether they let the play. Yeah, the clear, irrefutable proof, whatever it is, that the call was wrong. Otherwise, they say if it's close, we don't touch it. So again, if you've got a case where you say clearly, we would have a crummy tort system if we couldn't make room for a case like Mrs. Johnson's daughter. She deserves something here, and the state of New York ought to, you know, fork over the dough here. And where we draw that line, again, is a somewhat subjective case. I give you another example at the end of Steinhauser case on page 21, this last note, number 5 in the right-hand column, just before the section on punitive damages. Somebody goes to Kaiser, one of the early HMOs, they erroneously, mix up the lab samples or whatever and tell this woman that she's got syphilis. I got good news and bad news. You know, the good news is you really don't have syphilis. In that case, I'm greatly relieved. But does she deserve some compensation for the emotional distress that she underwent while she's dealing with this false information? Again, as with AIDS phobia or whatever else it is, you have to figure out, okay, is this more like the dry cleaning unpleasantness that we simply expect people to endure, or is it more like looking into the coffin and finding out that's not really your mother lying there? Mr. Cafferty. I don't think these are questions as much about foreseeability. That will go into the question whether they were negligent, whether they proximately caused the injury. But I think with respect to damages, it comes down to essentially a policy question. Can we, as a matter of public policy, make more room at the table for this claim and still keep our rule intact? Or is this case so close to the average garden variety negligently inflicted emotional distress that if we let claims like this through the door, we've essentially lost control of the system? That's the judgment that the court's going to make. And as we'll see throughout this chapter, different judges have different bending points. Some are, you know, more like Cardozo, kind of, you know, they're a little bit more on the control freak side. Wow, I can't go there. Others are more kind of, hey, you know, room for one more here. Doesn't bother me. Relax. That's, again, this sort of almost temperament issues. And again, as you represent a client, whether the defendant or the plaintiff, trying to evaluate the likelihood that this case is going to get through the door, you want to kind of ask yourself the question, how close do I think am I to special circumstances, guarantee of genuineness, versus how likely is it that even a judge not as rigid as Cardozo is going to look at this and say, hey, I'm sorry, I just can't help you here. Yeah. Well, I think with respect to emotional harm, again, it's sort of like Mr. Cafferty's question about foreseeability. Someone, in order to state a claim here, would have to be somebody that's sufficiently closely related so that the harm of looking in and seeing that's not really... I mean, I would guess that the sister of the decedent, the aunt in this case, who also looks into the coffin and sees it's not her sister, she's not going to be as traumatized as the daughter. It's the daughter who's really... the one who's losing it here. And again, as other people line up at the cashier's window and say, hey, while you're at it, cut a check for me too, they're going to face the same issue of saying, how confident are we that, gee, this is a jaw-dropping kind of case. And that might apply to the daughter, but not to the sister. But I don't know. I mean, again, part of it is the way she describes her own reaction, but I think a large part of it is before we ever get to her reaction, let's hear what happened. So again, the lady on the train, you describe what happened to her, and everybody says, yeah, is there an, you know, where's the punchline here? I'm still waiting for the punchline. Whereas in this one, you know when the punchline's hit, and without hearing what her reaction was, you can easily imagine her depression, you know, hysterics, and so forth. Okay, well, we need to pick up with the Steinhauser case tomorrow, not tomorrow, Monday, and then we'll move on to talk about punitive damages.